You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 485 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we're coming to you in separate locations. I'm in Seattle, Washington, home of the AL West champion, Seattle Mariners.
What?
They didn't stop being the AL West champion. Are you disputing that? Oh, wow.
That sneeze wasn't for the Mariners, but it might have been the cookies that we're going to discuss. I'm coming from Renton, Washington, home of that we're going to discuss in the future. Where are we at in DVOA right now?
Number one?
Home of the number one in DVOA. Where they belong, the rightful DVOA champion, Seattle Seahawks. Have fun with your little AL West champion Mariners. Baseball season is over, buddy.
It's not a competition between the Mariners and the Seahawks.
It's like 40 degrees outside. It is gross. It is rainy. It is football season. And the Seahawks are number one in DVOA. It's 2012 all over again.
It was a high of 60 today. But did you listen to this?
I dream of every single night come true, and it is 2012 again? Yes, it is. Take me back.
Take me back. Okay. Well, if you haven't listened to it already, I don't know if you're aware of this. The Seattle Mariners season came to an end. They were playing the Toronto Blue Jays. A notable game. Game 7, ALCS. Some decisions were made. Some home runs were hit. And they lost. And we recorded afterwards. We also recorded about the Seahawks blowing out comfortably beating the Texans on Monday Night Football, and looked back on the 2 weeks that I was in Europe. But there was a lot we didn't get to, including with those teams, including previewing this weekend's UW football game. So we are back to do that in what we are considering the full regular weekly pod.
And why is it that I went to the Alex Bannister edition?
You know what I went to? That respect to it. I went to the Your Birth Year edition.
Oh, 1985. Wow, spoiler alert on my birth year.
That information is probably not that hard to find out.
Well, not now.
All right. Should we get into our toast?
I guess I should have specified 19.
You're actually 140 years old.
That's how it feels sometimes. Let's get into toad.
First off, hey, congrats.
Look, dreams are coming true right now. It is 2012 again, so I feel like that might be a year I'd go back to. It's like, what are the years that I would go back in time to? I feel like 2012 is like a pretty solid one. And then, obviously it's like, 1996 or something. But I'm like, I really think I need the modern conveniences.
Right. You're going to be so upset when you get to 1996 and you don't have a smartphone to document anything that's happening. But 2012, what are you losing technologically?
Almost nothing. Two children.
Earbuds. That's a strange answer for technologically.
Well, they've got a lot of iPads. So.
Fair point. Luca was not very proficient with technology in 2012 itself. We're starting with a congrats to Rain OG Lou Barnes, who announced her retirement at season's end, one of three original Seattle stars alongside Megan Rapinoe and Jess Fishlock. Barnes has played all 13 Rain seasons, is the NWSL's all-time leader in both games and minutes, won NWSL Defender of the Year in 2016, one of two appearances on the NWSL's Best 11, and still playing an important role, including on Friday in her final regular season home game at Lumen Field, possibly her last game period at Lumen Field. We'll determine that soon. Congrats to the Rain on clinching a return to the NWSL playoffs with Friday's 2-1 win over Utah in that celebration for Lou Barnes, with her starting on the back line. All right, this was an interesting timing. Congrats to Dan Wilson, voted by his peers Sporting News AL Manager of the Year.
Yeah, man. Sure.
It appears based on his post-game comments that you got John Schneider's vote.
Wait, what did John Schneider say?
That, like, when he saw Bizzardo coming out of the bullpen to face Springer, that he thought, quote, game on. So, not ideal when you hear that from the other manager. Congrats to Jonah Coleman.
We're just moving past that one.
Why you didn't say anything?
I was anguishing for a second. Okay. I was getting in a little bit of drama.
Again, Jesus, the anguish Christ. Doesn't you're really the
one,
work well.
You're the one who is in Europe. Why can't this podcast be a little bit more European for a second here?
If we want to move to the YouTube model, we can have silences and your face can tell the story.
Jesus Christ. Yeah, we're on Netflix now. People are going to watch that. I'm sure bookmarking that for its cancellation.
I wish nothing but the best for my friends at the Ringer. In they're not a, they're
this is not wishing anybody Netflix. Bad. It's just what are we doing? Look, my feelings have been made very clear on the subject, but
we are pivoting to audio. Yeah. Actually, eventually we might pivot to text. I don't know. I always considered dropping the notes in the Discord. When I was on vacation.
Anyway. Yeah, I stand by my shirt. Fuck it. Whatever. Dan Wilson.
I think you broke it down well on the emergency pod. It was a bad decision. It was not a decision that itself single-handedly cost them the game. It wasn't a 100% win probability swing on bringing Edward Bizzardo out of the bullpen instead of Andres Munoz. And the thing people never talk about in that is like, well, who was going to pitch the ninth? You were certain that Matt Brash was going to make it through unscathed if Munoz had come in there? Dan Wilson did speak about it. The Mariners held their end of season availability on Thursday, because I think that's what day this is. And one of the things Wilson pointed out is that because of the fact that they didn't have anyone up at the start of the inning, by the time Wu had walked the leadoff batter and it became more realistic that they were going to need to make a mid-inning change, it's harder for Munoz to get loose as quickly in that situation as
they
someone
could have planned for that. Like that's a little bit of like the,
it's
you know,
fair
that
you could have had
we'll
him
talk about Adam Silver in the hot dog suit later, but like
we will not talk about that. Actually,
oh, sorry. We will not talk about Adam Silver in the hot dog suit later, but like, he could have just had Andres Munoz warm. But I agree that it's a little bit, people treat it like it's like, oh, just do this. You know what I mean? But as if they, like,
well,
pause doesn't have effect, if that makes sense.
Well, they just like, they yada yada over the rest of it. Like, you probably were going to have to face the top of the order twice, most likely. Granted, the Mariners didn't pull that off in terms of making the Blue Jays face Cal Raleigh twice, but that's neither here nor there.
Well, when Gino walked, they did. But
well,
like,
apparently Gino did get a
but that's
a
the thing. No, this,
on
this is where I don't agree with. Just because you get a bad call earlier doesn't make the strikeout call. It doesn't negate the fact that it was a ball on 3-2. It's not like, that's not how this works. You know what I mean? It's not like if there's
adjust.
A bad call earlier in the game, you're just like, well, we're just going to change this now. Like that's some,
but
like,
I think you can't say that, you know,
it was a close call on one of them. It was like more strike zone than it was ball. But the fact is, the last pitch, if it were challengeable, that you're more likely to challenge the ball four call.
Yeah,
than
no,
you are
the Blue Jays
to challenge
are not
going to
challenge ball. I think it was one in that case. I think it moved it.
No,
to
it was ball.
It was pitch two, but I don't know if it's ball two.
I don't.
It might have
exactly.
been a first pitch strike.
I think it was ball two, but like the. If it was ball four, if it was challengeable and the Mariners could have challenged, right? If Gino could tap his head there, like, which he should have done condescendingly, but it's a walk at that point. You know what I mean? So, like, I do think just judging the stakes of the pitch being a 3-2 pitch being called wrong is a greater stake than, oh, at some point earlier in the at bat.
Yeah, because there's more time to adjust earlier in the at bat, but it is harder to say that, like, he took four balls.
Are we going to talk more Mariners later? Are we going to talk more looking back on the Mariners later? Or are we going to...
I didn't have it on the schedule. I don't know if you have any hot takes prepared.
These aren't hot takes necessarily, but do you know what I did? I did a crazy thing. The next morning, I got in the car. It was early in the morning. and I didn't have any podcasts or anything queued up. You know, I couldn't get my Netflix to load. And I listened to, I shit you not, sports radio.
Oh, no.
And Mike Salk was taking phone calls from the listeners.
I'm sure they were measured and reasoned in their comments.
I mean, honestly, they mostly were.
Oh.
It was not, but apparently there were, I heard the tail end of this, multiple people. A lot of them were just like, hey, Salk. It's like the thought of whoever is like calling into sports radio in 2025 is a crazy thought to me. When you could literally just post your thoughts anywhere. You know what I mean? It's not like people, it's not the 90s. Like, you have just outlets.
You could just host your own podcast. Yes, back then I had to call either Groz or Gas to get my Sonics takes off.
There's just so many ways to get your person. You could start anything, right? There's so many accounts to get your perspectives out there. But like the...
Sounds strange when you put it that way.
One of the, well, threads. I'm just like, every once in a while you click on a thread where you're like, that's a crazy post. I've got to check this out.
Is there, I don't have it installed, so I don't actually
no,
think that.
No, it pops,
I'm like,
scrolling Instagram, and then I know. Thread. Oh, if you don't have threads installed,
yeah,
it
so
doesn't show up.
I don't know, maybe it does or maybe it doesn't. I don't click on it. I'm just like, well, I wish that had not been on threads, because then I might have seen it. Or is there like a suburban dad just giving Mariners takes on TikTok? And if not, why isn't that you?
Oh, I guarantee that there is.
Okay.
But God, there was one thread about Cooper Kupp where I was just like, I gotta click on this. I'm so sorry. Where it was like the interception that Cooper Kupp threw. It's like some bullshit account or whatever made people question the Seahawks decision making. And I'm just like, what are you talking about? Or are the Seahawks trying to do too many trick plays? And I'm like, thanks, threads. Anyway, there was a dialogue that apparently had settled in, which was, and this is what people were calling into Mike Salk about, which he rejected vehemently, which was, the Mariners talent-wise aren't good enough at hitting. And it felt like, and they were like 7-8-9. The Blue Jays are just so much better than the Mariners. And Mike Salk broke it down. He was like, throughout the season, 162 games, not seven, the Mariners were better at 7-8-9 in the lineup than the Blue Jays were. And just because these seven games, like the bottom of the order, didn't deliver, doesn't negate the entire season before then. They just didn't show up in this one series. And he was basically like, what the fuck are you talking about? And it feels like people have one take about the Mariners, and they're just like, they have a desperate need to go back to that.
Oh, yeah. We must go back.
I was so happy that he was just like, he shut it down. He's like, we've gotten three calls like this. And he was like, I just reject this as a concept that is what, like, maybe it swayed the series. But I think the thing that people don't understand about baseball series is that they're mostly fucking random. Like, we know this about baseball. That's why random teams win almost every season. It's not the type of sport. Look, it would be boring. Honestly, it would be the NBA if you just went into every series.
Pretty boring opening week, I'd say. You know, just a real snooze fest thus far.
Well, the fireworks are not happening on the court. But in NBA playoff series, like, you can basically predict who's going to win. I think last year was maybe a more interesting NBA playoffs than there were. But like, your ability to predict who's going to win, what you care about more in NBA playoff series is how many games than you do about the teams most of the time. And that's not how baseball works, because it is a very fucking random sport. So if the 7-8-9 hitters, like, there's hard hit balls that some of them had during this time period, and sometimes they just go at people.
Yeah.
That's it.
It's all true.
So, I was annoyed that that's a thing that is creeping back in. And I'm like, all right, dog. But the other thing is, like,
I mean, I do think there is an element where, I mean, Leo Rivas was one of the 7-8-9 hitters for a number of games in the series.
Maybe we should consult with the Sporting News AL Manager of the Year about that one.
I do think there may have been some holes detected by the end of the playoff run here, but I also don't think that's like an insurmountable thing.
Every team has holes.
Because you know how I know that? Because the Mariners were leading 3-1 in Game 7 of the ALCS.
Exactly.
That's how I know it. It's inexhaustible proof.
What is?
that they were good enough, the talent-wise,
yes,
to win the series because they almost fucking won the series.
You can't look. The no holes argument is basically like
you can't both think that bringing in Bizarro when they did cost them the series and think that they weren't talented enough offensively. Those are incompatible takes. They're mutually exclusive.
I just was like, every team is going to have some hitters that are better than other hitters. You know, some girls are bigger than others. Like that is the reality of the sport. And it's also the reality of every single sport. You know, it's not like 1940 where there are four teams. It's not the WNBA still currently, but like where
15, friend.
Okay, fine. Sorry. The WNBA 2 years ago, where it's basically like you could compile all of the talent in the league on one team. There are 30 teams who are competing for this. And
you can compile all the talent on one team. It's just called the Dodgers.
No, the Dodgers also have player hitters
yes,
who are worse
the
than
Dodgers,
other hitters.
The Dodgers 2 years ago, granted that was before Shohei Ohtani was on the team, did lose in the first round of the playoffs.
The Dodgers happen to have one player who is so much better than all of the other players that if you put a good enough roster around him, which the Dodgers have done and the Angels didn't, that it covers up a lot of mistakes. So I just am like, sure. Like, you need to find a reason that a random thing happened. We have to create a story from it. But the reality is they just didn't have that good of a series. And it's not like I just don't even know who to blame. Like, could you have gotten better players? It's like, maybe. Could they have spent more? Sure, but there's not a guarantee that those players would have delivered in a 7-game series either.
No.
And if your argument is just like they need better players, it's like, all right, dog, sure. Totally.
It is not a perfect roster. No matter what Mariners hot takes might say.
I didn't say it was a perfect roster. I said they had no holes, and they still didn't. Do you know what Canzone hit during the regular season?
It doesn't make it a hole.
It is a sample size issue. More than it is anything else.
I do think it is possible that with Dom Canzone specifically, there may be some element where in a series where you're facing top pitchers exclusively, his talent may not translate to the same degree. I'm not sure that
I buy that Dom Canzone, that there's this one player you can isolate. Like, the reality is that, or like Jorge Polanco only hits off really good pitchers, you know? It is randomness.
Yes, I don't think that.
It is a sport that gets played over 162 games, and they decide the playoffs by way less than that.
See,
they decide
about Tom
most
Canzone
playoff
is,
series.
He didn't play 162 games. He played 82 games.
Sure,
and he wasn't very
still
good prior to this season. So I do think there's a little
you?
More.
How
And
dare
I love
you?
Dom Canzone, and I'm not saying the Mariners
during
need
his prime, Dom Canzone.
I believe one of the things that Mariners management said during the end of the season press conference is the outfield is set. We're good. We're not open for business in the outfield.
Great.
So I don't think Dom Canzone's going anywhere. But I also would not look at the 2026 playoffs and say, for sure, Dom Canzone should be the Mariners starting right fielder / DH in the 2026 playoffs. They get there, which is its own problem.
I don't believe that these seasons have any bearing on each other. Like, Randy Rosarena had like one of
on each other.
That these playoffs do, like Randy Rosarena,
yes,
one of the best playoffs of all time, right?
I agree that playoffs.
That doesn't necessarily mean, like, we weren't like, oh, well, Randy Rosarena did good in the 2021 playoffs or whatever year it was with the Rays. It's not
2020.
Like 2020. In the 2020 playoffs, it's not like we're like, well, we could slot him in for 600 for the Mariners in 2025. It's fucking dumb. It is all small sample size.
It's very odd for me to be the person on this podcast who's more accepting of small sample size.
I feel like for the Mariners, we've like traded perspective, but I'm just like, I just, people are so desperate to find a scapegoat or a reason for why something mostly random happens. And
well,
it's just like,
way to explain like X thousand years of human psychology.
It's baseball in particular.
I know, my man. Like, I don't know if you're aware. Our whole culture is built on finding explanations for randomness.
Well, sure. But hockey, too. I feel like hockey is actually even more predictable, too. Because, like, if you were to pick betting favorites in each conference in hockey, like, that's who made it. Maybe that was true in baseball. I don't think the Blue Jays were, though.
I also do not.
I'm pretty
think they
sure
were.
The Yankees were the betting favorites.
I would want to see a larger sample size.
The Yankees are a better team than the Blue Jays are.
Yeah, probably.
And the Mariners probably. I think there's a chance that the Mariners would have lost to the Yankees sooner, quicker than they lost to the Blue Jays.
Quite plausible. Anyways, congrats to Jonah Coleman, named one of 16 finalists for the Campbell Trophy, the award for academic and athletic success, is named in honor of the late Bill Campbell, an all-Ivy League player and captain of Columbia's 1961 Ivy League championship team, who coached at the school before becoming the CEO and chairman of Intuit, which now is famously the sponsor of the LA Clippers, but not their jersey sponsor. That was a different group.
So what is that an academic or is it athletic? What is the
combination of academic and athletic success? I said that in there.
But I'm just trying to understand because I
highlighting maybe, his 3.191 GPA in education.
Maybe this is a bit of a hot take, I guess. I feel like Jonah Coleman has not had that good of a season.
No, that's not at all a hot take. But
it is fun. He still gets mentioned. I was listening to the
He scored a lot of touchdowns.
I was listening to the Ringer College Football Show with Van, where I'm like, give me whatever Van thinks about college football. I'm like, I want to hear it at the very least.
Of course. You know? It's gonna be delivered in an entertaining fashion.
But he doesn't have like wild perspectives about it. Van is like a very measured.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying anything Van is gonna talk about, whether he's informed about it or not, he's gonna talk about it in an entertaining manner.
And so he was talking about Jeremiah Love, and he was basically like, Jeremiah Love is the best running back in college football. And who's the other running back for Notre Dame? Jadarian Pierce, where he was like, those are the two best running backs together. I mean, Jadarian Pierce is averaging more yards per carry than Jeremiah Love is. And somebody like other people who got brought up, and it was like two other names, and one of them was Jonah Coleman.
And Jonah Coleman does lead the nation in rushing touchdowns.
Yeah, but I'm like, motherfucker, Jonah Coleman's.
We all know, but other people are not paying as close attention to the University of Washington football team
as
we are.
Counting stats that good. Like 5.1 yards per carry in college is like,
it's
fine.
Again, other people are not paying it. So they saw 12 touchdowns and that was the end of the analysis.
I'm just very fascinated about the usage of Jonah Coleman. He seems fine with it for what it's worth, because it's not been different from 2024 to 2025. And I keep being like, there's a point where Jed is going to start riding Jonah Coleman. It is not in Jed Fish's DNA to do that. That is what I've determined. I think it is not a Jonah Coleman thing. I think Jed he's just not going to ride a running back like that. Jed likes to throw the motherfucking rock. And you know what? Respect.
All right, should we get to the NBA update sponsored by Polyatri?
Are we doing the players to watch, by the way?
Of course we're playing the players to watch.
All right.
We have to do it quickly. Portland Trail Blazers head coach Chauncey Billups was arrested Thursday morning and charged with counts of wire fraud conspiracy and money laundering conspiracy as part of an investigation by the FBI into illegal poker games that the FBI alleges were fixed. Billups also matches the description of an unnamed co-conspirator in the related case regarding NBA inside information, indicating that he told a bettor that the Blazers were tanking and several players would sit out the team's March 24th, 2023 game against the Chicago Bulls before those players were ruled out on the injury report, and the line inevitably moved in response. Billups has been placed on administrative leave indefinitely by the NBA while this plays out, and the Blazers announced in their statement that Tiago Splitter, who's new to the coaching staff this year, was previously the head coach at Paris Basketball. I believe he had coached with the Brooklyn Nets as an assistant coach and most famous for his longtime playing career with the San Antonio Spurs, will serve as acting head coach. Kind of an interesting decision because they did also have former NBA head coach Nate Bjorkgren, who took over as acting head coach for two games last year. That happened to be the game that the Fabulous Pelton brothers attended against the Dallas Mavericks. So, there you go. That was a piece of information to wake up to this morning.
It certainly was. I mean, are we going to talk about Chauncey Billups in general, or
I don't know how much there is to say here.
I mean, my perspective about Chauncey was negative from the beginning. You know, once the sexual assault charges became public after his hiring, I thought the Blazers should have fired him immediately, to be honest.
It was during the process and between when Damian Lillard advocated for his candidacy and when he was subsequently hired.
I was very surprised that the Blazers stuck with Chauncey.
And it would also just... To go back to this, became public is probably not the correct way to put it, because it was a matter of public record. It just had been so long ago. This these charges dated back to his, I believe, rookie season in the NBA, but certainly the 1990s. And even those of us who were around at that point and following the league had not remembered them. They had not been part of the storyline of his work as an assistant coach or his time in media before he was up for head coach of the Blazers.
So, I mean, that kind of clouded my perspective about Chauncey the entire time. I honestly didn't care how he was as a coach, in as much as I even think that there's like value necessarily in an NBA basketball coach. The fact that in a city like Portland, to have Chauncey represent the team, basically the only, like, aside from soccer, the only professional sports franchise in Portland.
Portland Fire erasure. They have a head coach, for the record. Yeah.
Well, they didn't exist until this coming season. They have not played a game.
It is correct.
So to have somebody like that represent the team and the city of Portland, I was surprised by it. And I thought it was the wrong decision overall. So seeing this as like, I have no sympathy for Chauncey Billups, and I hope that he has coached his last game head coach of the Blazers.
Did you happen to catch the statement from his attorney about the
what
situation?
Was that?
Let me read that in its entirety. Anyone who knows Chauncey Billups knows he is a man of integrity. Men of integrity do not cheat and defraud others. To believe that Chauncey Billups did what the federal government is accusing him of is to believe that he would risk his Hall of Fame legacy, his reputation, and his freedom. He would not jeopardize those things for anything, let alone a card game. Furthermore, Chauncey Billups has never and would never gamble on basketball games, provide insider information, or sacrifice the trust of his team in the league, as it would tarnish the game he has devoted his entire life to. Chauncey Billups has never backed down. He does not plan to back down, do so now. He will fight these allegations with the same tenacity that marked his 28-year career. We look forward to our day in court. Chris Haywood, attorney for Chauncey Billups. So that's a statement. Of all the statements there are, that's one of them.
Definitely. I mean, what is the lawyer going to say? Be like, yeah, he did it.
Well, I think there are ways that you could deny the allegations in a different, perhaps more effective way. All right.
I mean, that's basically it, though, to me. I would be surprised if he ever coached a game for the Blazers ever again.
I would
be shocked.
Also be surprised.
And again, I saw it and I was like, good riddance.
The Blazers lost to Minnesota 108-104, I believe, was the final in that one on opening night, hours before this arrest. Led that one in the fourth quarter, but Anthony Edwards ended up putting it away by making a jumper over his one-time Georgia teammate, Tumani Kamara, in the late stages of that one. 118-114, I should say. 41 points for Ant Edwards. Jeremy Grant, who's coming off the bench this season, came off the bench for the first time since 2020 when he was playing for the Denver Nuggets, had 29 to lead the Blazers. They host Golden State coming off their overtime win over the Denver Nuggets to go to 2-0 on the back end of a back-to-back on Friday night. All right, with that, it is time for an annual tradition. The 10 NBA players, one Denver Nugget, and 9 other players for you to watch.
Do I have to find the Denver Nugget?
We have made a last-minute change based on the results of the rotations from...
Wow, of who the Nugget is?
Season opener, who the Nugget is.
Wow.
We begin our 10 players to watch with Boston Celtics first-round pick Hugo Gonzalez, who played last season in Spain. You know, an athletic wing, not someone who's exceptionally skilled at this period of time. Kind of compare him, I would say, to Christian Brown of the Nuggets is kind of the best case for him. Was playing with Real Madrid last season.
Are Celtics fans pretty excited about this one?
I don't know. They're pretty muted in it. He may not play a lot. I don't think that he played in their opener that I saw.
He did get a DNP CD in that one.
Ant Simons, 32 minutes off the bench, 13 points. All right, next up. The Brooklyn Nets are maybe the most player-to-watch team since the Jokic-Nurkic era Denver Nuggets. They had 5 first-round picks this year.
Oh, my God.
3 of those first-round picks are international. one of whom played in the NCAA. So two of them coming from overseas. And yet I have picked one of the NCAA players and technically an American, although also a representative of the Israeli national team, Michigan center Danny Wolf, who I don't know if you were, so he played against the Huskies last year, but I don't remember whether you watched this game because the Huskies got blown out, right?
No, I guess
they
were competitive. Watching some
it was
of
the
it.
Michigan
I thought we
State
were in
game.
It to
got,
like the.
You're right. You're right. They it was like kind of
I don't
famous,
remember Danny Wolf, but I do remember watching that game till the bitter end.
So he's 6'11". He handled the ball in a lot of pick and rolls for the for Michigan. We'll see how much he's able to do that at the NBA level, but certainly a very versatile, like known for his passing skill. So it's gonna be interesting to see how he translates to the NBA setting.
The Nets played like 13 people in their first game. How
That
many
sounds
people
about right.
Can you have rostered right now?
I think 13 is the maximum.
Yeah. Okay. They played 13 people, and Danny Wolf was one, not one of them.
I think he's going to get his time. His time will come. I don't worry about that. Hugo Gonzalez, we'll see. But
Do
Danny
we
Wolf,
want to try to guess where the players play, or do you just want to go into it?
Okay. I don't know whether you enjoy that or not, though, who he played
I
for.
mean, I don't enjoy that, but I feel like people do enjoy
Well,
my
the
incorrect
listener enjoyed it.
guesses. Yeah.
Okay. Well, next up.
It gives people a chance because a lot of people also know, and it's one of those
Right.
fun moments where
They can do it. All right.
call me
Next up
stupid.
is Spencer Jones.
That has to be the Pelicans.
Denver Nuggets.
Oh, that was the Nugget? I thought you were going to bury that one.
Spencer Jones went to Stanford during a period of time where they were in the Pac-12 against UW. And it says something probably about UW that you don't remember him whatsoever, despite the fact that he played 146 games at Stanford. Went undrafted last year on a two-way with the Nuggets. Didn't really play for them a lot as a rookie, but was in the rotation for opening night, which is what gave him the nod over Daron Holmes II, who was their 2024 first-round pick, who did not see any action in the opener coming off an Achilles injury that robbed his entire rookie season. Spencer Jones, a good shooter and like has generally rated pretty well in my metrics. So an interesting situation for him to be getting minutes. I don't think he really did anything against the Warriors.
Aaron Gordon scored 50 points?
Yeah, he scored 15 points. He made 10 three-pointers.
That's a wild one. Okay.
That's the season now. Things are happening. All right, next up. Will Richard.
Oh man, I recognize this name. Washington Wizards.
Golden State Warriors. He played. I don't know if he did
I could
play
have
in this
scrolled
game,
down on
but
this box score that I'm on.
yeah, he still played 17 minutes in this one. Okay. Yeah. I mean, he's playing a lot. Was one of the last picks of the 2025 draft, going number 56 overall after helping Florida win a national championship. Someone who's been on my radar is a draft prospect for a long period of time. And when I've watched him play, so he wore number 5 at Florida, and he kind of physically looks somewhat like DeJounte Murray. It always stuck out to me. So I was a fan. I didn't necessarily expect him to get drafted, but the Warriors did put him on a full NBA contract, and he is in their rotation immediately and helping them. Won the national championship last year. I didn't mention that. Okay, next up, Talen Peter.
Memphis Grizzlies.
Indiana Pacers. Where he also won the spot in this by being in
Did
the
you go
rotation
deeper
on
on
opening
these
night.
this year? Are these deeper cuts or
I would say
do I
so.
just not? I don't know anything.
I think they're always pretty deep cuts.
Okay.
So Talen Peter is an interesting one. He didn't come on my radar draft-wise until very late in the process. He played very 6 games at Tennessee Tech as a freshman, then went to Arkansas Tech, which is Division II. Came back to Division I for his 5th year at Liberty. Came off the bench, oddly, but won Sixth Man of the Year in Conference USA. Put up a very wild stat line where he shot high percentages on twos and threes. He shot 58% from the field, 45% on three. Obviously crushed my projection model once I finally put him in here. Didn't think he was going to get drafted, but the Pacers took him number 54. And with TJ McConnell sidelined, he was their backup point guard on opening night. So going to be very interesting to see how this works. Given, you know, the low level of competition that he's played at historically.
I mean, got more minutes than Isaiah Jackson, who started.
The Pacers going with a three-headed center right now. All right, next up, Yoan Berenguer. Had, I think, set a summer league record for blocks in his debut.
That sounds like a Raptors type name.
Minnesota Timberwolves. He is the new Rudy Gobert.
Oh, interesting.
Defensive minded French center who struggles offensively. I mean, I've looked at their box score. We just talked about it a moment ago, but I did not really peep whether Berenguer got any run. I don't think he probably did because, you know,
he didn't play.
Yeah, they obviously have plenty of options in the front court with Naz Reid sliding down to the center. But I think Berenguer may get some run at some point this season. It'll be interesting to see how he translates. All right, next up, Ariel Hukporti.
The San Antonio Spurs.
New York Knicks, where he started on opening night with Josh Hart sidelined and also Mitchell Robinson sidelined for this one. Played 18 minutes, has really impressed me with his ability to kind of handle the ball and be a hub for the Knicks offense at the elbow. It's a very different Knicks offense than we saw under Tom Thibodeau with Mike Brown taking over as head coach this season. Hukporti is one of the handful of players in this list who is not, in fact, a rookie. He was a second round pick for the Knicks last year, was on the roster, didn't play obviously a whole lot, but getting more opportunity this year. He is a German native.
Did you see Cam Scataboo on Celebrity Row at the Knicks game?
I missed that, sadly.
I think Cam Scataboo is the most important person in the entire city of New York.
More so than Jackson Dart.
Oh, no, it's a Scataboo city. That is what I will say. Yeah, no, Jackson Dart, because there's a thing about New York, right? I mean, there's two things about
New
York.
The underdog.
The underdog, but also just like how Cam Scataboo plays football. The fact that he is a white running back. The skin color of... very New York, and it is very, very Giants, right? So kind of covering that like Jersey New York relationship between those. I think one of my favorite things about New York is how quickly it is willing to rally behind an athlete that has done something in a short period of time, right? Like the fervor that can build around somebody like that. Cam Scataboo is like, he might be the most important New York like young athlete in a generation at this point.
Interesting.
Seeing him there on Celebrity Row, and from the intel that I've gotten, it's like on the streets of Jersey, every single Giants jersey is a Scataboo jersey. And because Dart feels like an outsider, you know what I mean? Like
Scataboo sanity.
Jackson Dart, and like the thing is about Cam Scataboo is obviously he went to Arizona State. He feels like he has always been on the New York Giants.
He was born on the New York Giants. He'll be on the New York, much like Josh Johnson will still be signing with NFL teams long after you die. The Scataboo will still be playing for the Giants. All right, next up on our list, Brooks Barnheiser.
I'm going to say Brooks Barnheiser is on the San Antonio Spurs.
Nope.
I'm going to get one of these, aren't I? Never? No.
I mean, there's only two left. We're pretty far down the list now.
Are there any Lakers on the list?
There are not. Don't really have anyone all that interesting this year. Oklahoma City Thunder.
Ugh.
Where someone else who kind of rose late in the draft process, they took him with the 44th overall pick, signed him to a two-way contract, and he has been prominently in the rotation early this season with Jalen Williams sidelined thus far, still coming back from, I believe that was wrist surgery.
But Jalen Williams played yesterday.
That's fair. Jalen Williams did play. Cason Wallace also sat out against the Pacers on Thursday night. So the Thunder were going deep. AJ Mitchell has really taken advantage, but Brooks Barnheiser has been in the rotation as well. A fun fact about Brooks Barnheiser, who went to Northwestern, was a Big Ten rival for the Huskies.
I remember hating him.
He grew up in Elkhart, Indiana. Do you know the most famous NBA player from Elkhart, Indiana?
Not Larry Bird.
No, French Lick.
Oh, yeah, duh, French Lick. Elkhart, Indiana? I have no idea.
Sean Kemp.
Oh, okay. All right.
Apparently, Gale Sayers also lived in Elkhart County, according to the Elkhart Wikipedia page. There's one other NBA player listed, and that is, let me find this again. Ted Luckenbill, who played in the NBA from 1961 through 1963.
And what was Lickin' Bill's game like?
Yeah, I think he was he played in Wilt Chamberlain's 100-point game. Fun fact about him.
There we go.
No,
Probably
I
didn't
don't
get
know.
many shots off.
I think if they had a 3-point line, he might have been
Or
able to take
didn't
advantage
defend
of
very
it.
well. I see that
No, he was with
SG
teammate.
yeah, I mean, he got the ball to Wilt. That's all I needed to do. I see that SGA scored 55 points on 26 free throws, so the shit is staying the same.
All right, next up on the list, Noah
Gonna be a
Penda.
fun season. Noah Penda? Have we had a Raptor yet?
We've not had a Raptor yet.
Are there any Raptors on the list?
I can't say that
He's
now.
on the Raptors. Come on.
No, he's not on the Raptors. He's on the Orlando Magic.
Oh, that's a team that has a lot of these too. I feel like the Raptors are usually a pretty player to watch team.
Noah Penda is French, played in. Where did he play last season? Yeah, no, he was playing in France last year with Lamont. 32nd overall pick by the Magic. Good size, for his skill set and athleticism. Liked what I saw from him at Summer League. Probably not going to play a lot this year, but we're keeping an eye on him nonetheless. Our final player on the
Wait,
list.
I want to ask a question about the Magic.
Okay.
So, in your simulation that you ran, right?
Yes. You said you wanted to talk about this.
Did the Magic win the championship? Am I wrong
They
about
did win
that?
the championship. They beat the Golden State Warriors in the NBA Finals, went into the Chase Center and won Game 7 of the NBA Finals.
Wow. So you just picked out a random like simulation, right?
So the way it worked in the story, it kind of implied that like I was searching through to find an interesting one.
No, you just picked a completely random one, right?
I picked one and like no one won more than 55 games, I think. And it was like, well, no one's gonna enjoy this. So this was the second simulation I looked at, and I had not simulated the playoffs. It was only based on the regular season when I picked it out.
Did you, first off, is there any chance of that happening?
The Warriors, the Orlando Magic winning the championship?
Yes.
Oh yeah.
They're a legit title contender.
I mean, I think to me they are clearly one of the three best teams in the Eastern Conference.
Because it's
So
still, and this is not keeping up as much. It doesn't pass the sniff test to me that the Magic could be a title contender right now.
I mean,
And
the East is
especially with
wide
everything
open.
I've been hearing about how bad Paolo Banchero is.
I was very excited to finally say something nice about Paolo Banchero. It was like a thrilling moment for me. Again, I did not know that was happening when I picked that simulation, but when it happened, I felt some warmth
Well,
in
you had the Blazers
my
winning
cold dead heart.
the in-season tournament as well, right?
Losing in the finals to the
Okay.
Celtics
Making the finals of the in-season tournament
and making the
plus.
playoffs.
I mean, I definitely saw that one and I was like, all right, Kevin's doing his job here, finally. Who
Again, it was all random.
won in the most simulations?
I mean, Oklahoma City. I haven't specifically done the math on that, but the answer is Oklahoma City.
Okay. I mean, they're still the favorite to repeat.
Yeah, they're the overwhelming favorite.
But in the Eastern Conference, it's wide open, and that's between Orlando and New York.
Cleveland.
And Cleveland. Are those
I
the
mean,
teams?
I think Orlando is the third best team. Other people like Atlanta more than I do.
Like who?
My colleague Tim Bontemps,
Did
among
they make the
others.
playoffs last year?
They lost in the play-in, but they added Kristaps Porzingis and Nickeil Alexander-Walker. Now, Nickeil Alexander-Walker did shoot 1 of 11 for the field in their opener, and they lost at home to the Toronto Raptors. So it wasn't a great start for them for the old Atlanta Hawks. But the Magic also needed to work the stretch run to beat Miami without Tyler Herro. So I can't take a victory lap on Orlando just yet.
I just will believe it when I see it on the Hawks.
I mean, I think Atlanta is good. I just don't think they are necessarily top four in the East good. I'm somewhat higher on Indiana. I thought my in Boston than the rest of the world is. I thought even though Indiana lost this game, the fact that they took the Thunder to double overtime validated that opinion, especially with Andrew Nembhard playing. I don't believe he played at all in the second half of this one.
And Haliburton is expected back at any point this season, or
No, he'll be out the entire year.
is that the same with Jason Tatum, or
Maybe for Jason Tatum, but I mean, he got injured a full month earlier, and I still would be very surprised if he came back.
okay, who's last?
Also wanted to shout out Ryan Nemhard, got a consideration for the players to watch, but I didn't think you were going to accept a Gonzaga player on
I
there.
was going to say that's Gonzaga, right? Yeah.
Yeah. All right, last on my list, Sandro Mamukelashvili.
Oh man, I was hoping it was going to be N'Fale Dante.
Oh, that would have been a good one, but I don't know if he's going to play enough.
I was literally just looking. I was looking at the Hawks box score.
Did you know that N'Fale Dante is the first player to change teams via restricted free agency since fellow Hawk, I believe, Bogdan Bogdanovic in 2020?
Did I know that?
Because he was coming off a two-way contract.
Why don't you take a guess on whether I knew that or not?
He was coming off a two-way contract, and the Rockets couldn't afford to match this offer sheet, which was not even guaranteed. It was like $85,000 guaranteed. But the Rockets had to let it go, so the Hawks were
Oh.
able to get N'Fale Dante.
I've just learned things about N'Fale Dante that I
That he
don't
went to
like.
Oregon? You didn't remember? He was there for like 7 years.
The amount that I like, if
Paid
I am
attention to Edom?
watching,
Well.
well, yes, that, but also just like knowing who's on the other teams outside of.
I suppose this is more a me thing. Peyton Pritchard? You remember Peyton Pritchard went to Oregon, right?
It takes like a pretty notable player for me to remember them. Like the Rutgers guards, I was like, okay, I'm like paying attention to these dudes. But wait, I didn't guess where the last player played on.
Yeah, Sandro Mamukelashvili, the most experienced NBA player on this list. I think he's been in the league for
That
like 5 years.
has to be a Toronto Raptor.
That is a Toronto
There
Raptor.
we go.
You nailed it. He signed with the Raptors this offseason after previously playing.
Hello. That's why I'm the MVP.
The last three seasons for the San Antonio Spurs, for whom last season he scored 34 points in 19 minutes in a win over the New York Knicks in March. So I'm very excited to see what Mamu can do in a more regular role for the Toronto Raptors.
He's achieved a lot in terms of beard size. So, I guess beyond these players, when you look at players who are a little bit more towards more prominent, is there anybody who you feel like is going to stand out this year? Like, are there any like rookies or young players that you expect to have breakout seasons?
VJ Edgecombe was high in my projections, but
I mean,
he
I saw that. I saw his game one performance.
34 points, the most by a rookie since in their debut since 1959, when the aforementioned Wilt Chamberlain did it, also in Philadelphia. So that is some wild, wild shit. And just like watching him and Tyrese Maxey, they're both so fast. I don't know how any team is going to have two defenders capable of stopping both of them.
And VJ Edgecombe's like a legit player. I mean, he's the third pick in the draft.
Yes.
So it's kind of a legit 34 points, right? It's not a.
I mean, he's not going to average 30 a game or even probably 20 a game, but yeah,
but
no, I mean, it's not like a
sometimes
fluke.
Like a random fluke thing will happen where a player just scores a ton. He's going to put up a lot of points.
Yeah, I think he's got a legit chance to win Rookie of the Year based on what we've seen thus far.
Who would be the other competitors for it?
Cooper Flagg?
Oh yeah, okay, fair enough. How was
Maybe at some point.
How was Cooper Flagg in that first game?
Oh, not good, but he was playing point guard. And I mean, do I have a bold prediction that this Wemby guy is going to have a good year?
Is he going to continue playing point guard?
I mean, they could put D'Angelo Russell back in the starting lineup and shift him off that, but Jason Kidd, hasn't shown an interest in doing that as yet.
Is that not where Cooper Flagg should be?
I mean, he's a 3-4 by trade. I do think Jason Kidd, there's something to be said for, he played Giannis at point guard early in his career. I do think that helped Giannis develop his skill. So when he was actually alongside a somewhat
After
more
Jason Kidd had
legitimate
been
point guard.
fired, it was one of
Well, he
Jason
wasn't,
Kidd's.
I will
He's
say,
patting himself on the back.
Jason Kidd wasn't fired because of the fact that the Bucks offense, he was fired because of the fact that his defensive system did not work in
But
Milwaukee.
you would, yeah, but he's still like the Bucks were benefiting.
It is the, you can't respect the butterfly without respecting the caterpillar.
Yeah.
So, I hope we're going to say that someday about Noel Quinn and Dominique Malonga, who we're getting to later in this podcast.
I just, it is so funny where like, I don't have anything in particular against Cooper Flagg. Like any feelings about Duke that I have, or I feel like are pretty much gone.
Because
But
Duke is North Carolina now.
Duke will never. Do you understand?
I understand.
That style of play is different than culture. It's so fucking stupid when you say that. Duke
the culture
is
of
not,
the university.
Duke is Duke University. It is not just a basketball team.
I agree. The culture of the university can never be the same as the culture of North Carolina. It can never have the cultural significance of the historical significance of Charlie Scott breaking the ACC color barrier for Dean Smith. But in terms of the players they recruit,
but you have to you
they
never
have
respect
entirely
the fact
flipped the two.
Sure. But like the element of it is the fan bases more than it is the types of players that they recruit,
I suppose.
If that makes sense.
Matis Buzelis, I think, is going to have a nice year for the Bulls. He had 21 in their season opener as they beat Detroit, a result that I think is reflective of where I think those two teams are headed relatively this year.
Oh, but on the Mavericks thing, so I'm cheering against Cooper Flagg because I didn't like that the Mavericks got the first pick in the draft after trading Luka, which again is very complicated, that I would have any negative feelings about the Mavericks because I am happy about the destination that Luka got to.
It's all true.
But it just, I don't want them to have succeeded after doing something so dumb.
Understandable. Walker Kessler made a pair of three-pointers last night, so that was an interesting thing that happened. He had
He's still in
22
the Jazz.
points. The Jazz beat the Clippers by 21, and it wasn't that close. So that was an interesting result.
Who do you think will be the worst team in the NBA this year?
Washington Wizards.
Oh.
You can certainly make a case for the Brooklyn Nets, but the Wizards have the worst projection in the current version of this model for me.
Just a really depressing team.
Although the Nets lost by 19 in their season opener to the Hornets, which was not a real strong start for them.
Didn't the Wiz end up with like not a particularly good pick either?
They actually got, I mean, they got the sixth pick.
I love getting a text from Jan, by the way. Quote, "Boy, you lucked out today." I was like, wow, what?
Oh, the Alaska Airlines flight.
Alaska Airlines stopped flights and many people are stranded. What happened?
They had an IT issue, but not an Amazon Web Services issue. All right, we got to move on. We've got a lot more to get to.
Okay. Do we? This is more fun than any of that.
Mariners offseason.
Wait, who did the Wizards draft, though? I want to.
Trey Johnson, who had a nice debut. I was not a big believer in him based on his defensive metrics, but he had 16 points on 5 of 11 in his debut, made 4 three-pointers, shot it well in summer league. So I'm coming around on Trey Johnson. And very high on Keyshawn George, who had 21 points in 9 boards in this one, made 3 three-pointers. So
Mariners,
that was
off-season.
my less obscure player, Keyshawn George. Yeah. All right, so Mariners free agents. Josh Naylor.
Gone. No, not gone. Resigned.
Hopefully not. Jorge Polanco, who has a $6 million player option. Do you think he's going to take it? I don't know. Tough to say. Eugenio Suarez.
He's gone.
Caleb Ferguson.
Also.
Did he even pitch in the... Was he even on the roster for the LCS? I think he was, but did he pitch at all? Mitch Garver has a mutual option for $12 million with a $1 million buyout. I think you can guess where the Mariners are going to head on that one. So...
What does mutual option mean?
It only would become a contract if both Mitch Garver wanted it and the team wanted it.
So it's going to be $1 million to Mitch Garver.
Exactly. It's also like there's almost never a situation where it would be mutually beneficial, the option.
I will say, he knew it when he signed this deal. It's not like Mitch Garver. I mean, who knows?
I think he probably thought he was going to rake.
I thought they should have pinch hit Garver for Rivas in that inning in the ninth.
Reasonable.
It's not really worth $11 million, but
I wouldn't totally rule out that Garver is going to be back, although I think probably it's more likely that they'll
I sure would.
Harry Ford.
It's also one of those things where it's basically like, would the Mariners want Mitch Garver for the veteran minimum or $2 million or something like that? Maybe as depth, but it's similar to the type of thing where it's like after you've been let go, it's just a little bit harder to come back.
And there's probably going to be a situation where he can play more where the starting catcher isn't Cal Raleigh.
I mean, like, he doesn't have quite as much power. Carlos Santana was very informative to me, though, that especially with Mitch Garver playing in a more premium defensive position as well, not necessarily being good at it, but like a position that teams are going to need. Mitch Garver's going to find a job.
Yes, without question.
I bet Mitch Garver gets $5 to $6 million.
Plausible. I'd say four, if we're doing an over-under. All right, here's what Jerry Dipoto had to say on the team's payroll is they did that off-season press conference. I would say similar to where we ended the year as a starting point, which was about $165 million, depending on the accounting of the various financial websites that are out there. We ended the season, I think, with the second highest or highest payroll that we've ever had as a franchise, and this was always the goal, to methodically build toward what we were doing. He also said, I don't have the specific quote, but that they would again be in position to potentially add payroll over the course of the season, as they did to get to that $165 million range this year. So they presumably begin the offseason with about $130 million in commitments, including the estimates from using FanGraphs for the salaries that they're going to pay to players in arbitration. So you're looking at about $35 million to try to re-sign presumably Naylor and Polanco, and then maybe add a couple of veterans to that. So it's plausible. It's certainly doable. I mean, I think Naylor is going to be very much a years, not dollars situation on both sides. It's going to be maybe the bigger variable.
Dollars, too. Are there any... Do we think that there's any chance that the Mariners are in on basically big-name free agents are Kyle Tucker, Cody Bellinger? I mean, they said that their outfield is set, right?
I mean, you know, like I said, the math is they're going to have somewhere around $35 million to spend. I don't think you can spend that all in one player, given the number of holes they are. I mean, maybe if they're really convinced that, you know, Williamson is the answer at third, but you still would, in that you can DH Canzone and play Robles in the outfield most of the time. I think you got to sign two infielders at a minimum, two starting caliber infielders.
Well, then it's Pete Alonso, Alex Bregman. I would be pretty nervous about the Bregman contract. Just, I mean, honestly, both of them, given the age. Josh Naylor, fortunately, is a couple of years younger than most people who are hitting free agency, right? He's still in his 20s.
He's so got that speed that's going to age well.
But we have seen that he's capable of hitting in Seattle. And it's nice that there's going to be an adjustment period for basically any hitter coming here. I feel it's kind of been the case. And so it's nice to know that Josh Naylor is already accustomed to the ballpark, kind of knows what it's going to look like and has been successful here. I would be shocked if he wasn't back.
I wouldn't be shocked just because, look, all it takes is one team to blow the Mariners away. I also, like, we probably shouldn't expect him to continue to be quite as effective as he was this season, given the ballpark factor. You know, he had 2.2 WAR after joining the Mariners. His previous career high in his season, this is B-WAR, was 2.3. But he's, like, his approach offensively is someone who was skeptical about the trade, like, totally won over by it. Jerry Dipoto was effusive in praising him today. I certainly think that's their plan A.
I mean, the like, it only takes one team. That's not how it works necessarily in baseball, I feel like. Like, if the Mariners want to get this deal done, like, sure, he'll hit the market or whatever, but, like, it just takes so long for these deals to get done, and I don't think there are that many teams out there who are like, we want to go spend $25 million on Josh Naylor, something like that.
Right.
Who want to spend that extra chunk of money. Like, even with the big free agents, it takes so long for those deals to happen that, you know, it's not basketball or football where they happen instantly, and it's basically just like, who's giving me the most money? That's where I'm going. I think if the Mariners have the inside track on Naylor and it looks like it's going to happen, the rest of the teams will just back off. You know, I don't think it's like there's going to be a bunch of teams who are going to be in the mix and push them on it. It's really more about, like, it's almost closer to the negotiations that probably would happen behind the scenes during the season. It's just getting to the number that they feel comfortable about and how long that takes.
Yep.
So, I mean, even looking at the Spotrac projections, there aren't that many players who... People are going to be mad that the Mariners didn't sign some of the big-name free agents. because that's just how it's going to go. I just don't really know who among these players make that much sense to them right now, aside from, you know, just kind of like batting down the hatches. But there's a lot of young players that have to come up, and I think it will be a little bit more about, you know, they still have those prospects. They still have a deep farm system and have the ability to do a similar thing that they did with Randy, to do a similar thing that they did with Naylor and Gino during the season, and basically go in the season and be like, okay, this is where we feel like we're set. But if they're around 500, just above 500 in June, July, depending on how things look with the rest of the division, go out and make those moves that say, hey, this is how we get to the ALCS and then beyond that.
I do think also they're going to want to give some of their own young players an opportunity. You know, we'll see to what degree Cole Young is a part of that. Ryan Bliss, it's easy to forget about him because he was out most of the season, but we'll be back in the mix for next year. And then at some point, Cole Emerson, who hit at, you know, particularly at the AAA level, but hit well at every level he was at last year, is an extraordinarily young prospect. And it would be very surprising if he's not part of the roster at some point in 2026. Maybe it's not, you know, the start of the season, but at some point. But yeah, to your point, you look at it, it's a lot of outfielders at the top of the free agents. It's a lot of starting pitchers that they're not going to be in the market for. So you sort of identified the players who probably are a fit for them.
I mean, I would be excited if they went out and had a conversation with Pete Alonso, but it's kind of like, is Pete Alonso at 30 years old worth double what Josh Naylor is worth?
Probably not.
And especially not, you know, knowing that there's probably going to be an adjustment to the ballpark. I feel like he doesn't solve a problem. And I think, I'm sure that they've already had serious conversations with Naylor.
I think so too.
I'll be interested to see on Gino. I would be surprised if Gino is back, but
with Gino, to me, it feels like it would be like a Polanco situation, basically, where the market just didn't materialize. But he's also coming off a season where he hit 50 home runs, and not a season where he was plagued by injury and playing primarily exclusively at half his games at T-Mobile Park. So
yeah. He's one of the older, like higher tier free agents, for what it's worth. Here's what my thought on Gino was basically like, I think there is a chance that it is, as long as Gino doesn't get too much money, I feel like there's a way that this is like a Seahawks type situation and Gino may find his way back to Seattle.
You're saying after? Not this contract, but beyond that?
No, I mean, I think he might sign somewhere and do that for a little while.
Yeah, yeah.
And then get traded back to Seattle for a third time.
It's already happened once. Why not do it again?
So I wouldn't be upset about it. I mean, I loved Jorge Polanco, but it kind of just feels like,
I do think there's a pretty good chance. If we're doing our like percentage chances of return, I do think Jorge Polanco is probably more than top 50, more than 50-50.
There's a higher chance for Jorge than Gino for sure. But I think the roster, and then they have to go find a little bit of bullpen help. And I think that's definitely something like one or two more arms out of the bullpen, I think, is going to be important for them to find. And honestly, another lefty that they can count on as well. I mean, the way that Dan really cares about playing splits, having it just be Gabe Spire's job and that's it, is just difficult for them. And they really didn't have another lefty out of the bullpen that they trusted.
Yep. I mean, they thought that Ferguson was going to be that guy and he just wasn't.
So I think the roster is going to look fairly similar to this year's roster. I'm guessing next season is the year where it's kind of like, depending on how the next season goes, but the offseason, obviously they're going to be heading into a lockout probably in offseason heading into 2027. It's going to look very different than it did for the 2025 season. But right now, I wouldn't be surprised if the team that came back was roughly mostly similar. And then you have Cal entering another, like, into his prime, Julio in his prime. Like, there's a lot of players who are young players that are just in their prime, and then prospects that I think we're going to be excited to see. And if they could get anything from Cole Emerson in 2026, which I wouldn't be surprised again, if they, you know, started opening day with Cole Emerson on the roster, if he has a good spring, they're going to find a place for him to play.
It's certainly plausible. Yeah. And I think one of the things I've been thinking about is that they may do sort of the Seahawks thing of like, you sign a veteran who's cromulent, you know, whether it's at somewhere in the infield or at catcher to compete with Harry Ford. And it's basically like, we don't want to give this guy the job. We want to make them earn it but we also don't want to block them. And that strategy has worked out so well for the Seahawks, but this year it did. Everything worked out for the Seahawks this year. Should we do the roundup?
Sure.
For the first time in 3 weeks.
Are we going to talk Seahawks at all, by the way?
I don't have any notes for them.
Okay, speaking of which, of finding a place for somebody on the field, do you tire of being wrong?
Which one is this about?
You're not even aware? It was not the Tyler Lockett release. We had a conversation. I don't know if you recall this. Maybe you were too busy packing. About you were like, I'm not sure if Nick Emanuori is going to be on the field.
Oh, yeah.
Since then, where is he at in PFF right now?
I mean, I'm sorry. I didn't realize that he was going to be like an amazing flat
third
quarter.
Among quarterbacks in the NFL, excluding nobody. Nick Emanuori. I'm telling you, John Schneider, both.
He cooked
found
this offseason.
The juice again. John Schneider found it. He did the Bruce Irvin shit right now. And Nick Emanuori is Russell Wilson. Like, he went out there. We saw it earlier in the season. You've been gone. I've been waiting for 3 weeks to talk about how great Nick Emanuori is.
I mean, Nick Emanuori wasn't, I guess he probably had a good game against the Jaguars, but it couldn't have been as good as his game against the Texans, could it?
They have Devin Witherspoon not playing, he's out there. Like, this is defense that is going to be scary good.
They might need to trade someone, not because of the fact that, like, Reek Woolen is underperforming because he played awesome against Houston, but just because they can't put all these guys on the field.
It is incredible. I mean, also, yeah, like how good Reek Woolen's been playing.
Ty Okada?
It is both a Mike McDonald's defense piece, but I told you the second that they drafted Nick Emanuori, it was like, they drafted Gray Zabel, and that was like, that's like, go give Clint a guy, right? He's got this scheme.
That's one for them. This is one for us.
Nick Emanuori, the way that they traded up for him, and I was like, oh, Mike sees something here. You know what I mean? Whereas like, I bet they had written down Nick Emanuori, or what was the exact quote?
No matter what.
No matter what. Like, that is, I think that was the player that they cared the most about in the draft. And they have been proven so correct. And you argued like 3 weeks ago, cold takes over here, that maybe he wouldn't see the field. The third best cornerback in the NFL.
I'm glad to be wrong. You said before this you did not wish to do this podcast. I just want to remind you when you said that.
So hyped on Nick Emanuori. Just that the Seahawks got another cornerback who's.
I don't think he's a cornerback because I think he's actually kind of positionless. Number two,
secondary player. Like, we have been blessed in the city of Seattle with players in the secondary who are awesome.
There is a little bit with Emanuori. Not that like a. distrust it or that it's fluky, but we got so hyped on the rookie seasons of both Reek Woolen and Devin Witherspoon, and like, look, if they're this good as rookies, imagine how good they're going to be going
but
forward.
That's,
and haven't
that's
seen
not
that yet.
He's good right now. We don't have to be like, I mean, whoa, what's
Reek
next?
Woolen was a Pro Bowler as a rookie.
When you have Cam Scataboo in his prime, you don't worry about what's next for Cam Scataboo. Ride the wave.
When are you pasting the Emanuori nameplate over your Russell
across
Wilson
the
jersey
Russell Wilson?
So that you can wear it?
It's a beautiful number. Like, I love Devin Witherspoon, but the two of them together in the secondary, it's like we went from Earl Thomas and Richard Sherman to all of a sudden Witherspoon and Emanuori.
All right, roundup time.
And
for the first time in 3 weeks, Seattle Kraken have started the season. They won their first two games, earned at least a point from their first five before suffering lopsided 5-2 and 4-1 losses in a back-to-back Monday and Tuesday. Number three goaltender Matt Murray, a former Stanley Cup winner, got the start on Tuesday as part of an unorthodox three-goalie rotation for the Kraken early in the season. Murray had played just two NHL games since April 2023, following bilateral hip surgery that cost him the entire 2023-24 season. Kraken bounced back Thursday with a 3-0 win in Winnipeg to wrap up their long road trip. Before that, the advanced stats were not really too kind to the Kraken, who were 28th in Corsi 4 percentage, 29th in Fenwick 4 percentage. Had outperformed their expected goal differential by 3 goals. So there's a little smoke and mirrors to the start for the Kraken, but they have been more competitive than we expected. They're back home Saturday to start a 5-game homestand. Seattle Sounders finished 5th in the West with 55
I like that we're rushing
points.
Through this. I'm just gazing upon our DVOA.
Okay, it's number one.
Oh, my God. Number one in special teams.
They got a 2-1 win Sunday at NYCFC on decision day with nothing really at stake, nothing at all at stake. But the bracket, what was at stake was who else they might face. And the bracket broke ideally with the West goal differential leaders, LAFC and Vancouver, in the 2 and 3 seeds on the other side of the bracket from the Sounders, not a potential opponent unless they make the Western Conference Finals. They will start as the number 5 seed by facing Minnesota United in a best-of-3 miniseries starting Monday in the Land of 1,000 Lakes. Their home match will be the following Monday, November 3rd, with Game 3, if necessary, scheduled for Saturday, November 8th. Minnesota United had a plus 17 goal differential, 6th best in MLS. They lost in the West semifinals last year in the debut of Welsh manager Eric Ramsey, a former assistant at Man United. Their deepest playoff run since losing to the Sounders in the West finals in 2020. They still have 3 starters from that game, including goalkeeper Dane St. Clair and midfielder Robin Lund. Sounders retained 7 starters from that 2020 matchup, which is pretty wild because it's a long time ago now. Minnesota swept the Sounders in the regular season, winning 3-2 in Seattle on June 1st, 1-0 at home on August 16th in a game that was probably closer than more favorable for the Sounders than that scoreline indicated. They were led by 10 goals and 7 assists from forward Tani Oluwaseye, who was sold to La Liga club Villarreal on August 29th. They went 2-2-2 over the last 6 matches without him. His departure leaves Argentinian designated player playmaker Joaquin Pereira is their leader with 6 goals, 8 assists in his first full MLS season. Thing to watch going into the series, The Guardian wrote a story in July headlined, quote, "The most aggressive set-piece team in the world plays in Minnesota." United had the Loons had 6 throw-in goals in the season's first half, and a Soccerment analysis in the piece showed they take more long throws and deep free kicks taken by their keeper from around midfield, where he just like sends it into the box to basically try to create a, you know, a free kick from like 30 yard situation than any other team in the world's top 30 leagues. So going to be interesting to see how the Sounders, who are occasionally shaky in their set piece defense, handle that. Certainly the focus in practice leading up to this. The Sounders will be without Pedro de la Vega, who unfortunately suffered a patella fracture in that season finale at NYCFC, on which surgery is expected to miss 6 months, which will affect his availability to start the 2026 season. The Sounders will get back Yaimar Gomez Andrade, one of those 7 starters left from the 2020 matchup between these two teams, having missed the last 3 games with a hamstring strain. Could have Ryan Kent for the first time since his hamstring strain on August 6th. Seattle Reign FC is heading into decision day on Sunday. They're unbeaten in 3 matches since we last recorded. Now 4th in the NWSL standings heading into their season finale against the Orlando Pride. They'll be in Orlando. The Pride sit 3rd in the standings. Reign could still finish anywhere from 3rd to 7th in the NWSL playoff picture, depending on the result of that game. A win would clinch 3rd, but a draw would leave the Reign vulnerable to getting passed by 3 teams and dropping all the way down to 7th. All right, Seattle Storm news. So Sandy Rondello will reportedly be the first head coach for the Toronto Tempo. We, you know, sort of expected that she would be a strong candidate for the Storm. It was reported by Ben Pickman of The Athletic that they interviewed her and had interest. You know, it has been described as a bidding war for Rondello, and Toronto ends up as an expansion franchise winning that one to get kind of the most proven WNBA coach on the market. Previously, the Portland Fire, as I alluded to, hired Cleveland Cavaliers assistant Alex Sarama, and the Dallas Wings subsequently on Thursday were reported to have hired USF head coach Jose Fernandez. That leaves the Storm and the New York Liberty, who fired Rondello, is the 2 teams left searching for WNBA head coaches this offseason. Ben Pickman of The Athletic reported that the Storm interviewed Liberty assistant Sonia Roman, who I highlighted, is a candidate to watch. He also mentioned former Storm guard Breon January, an assistant coach for the Indiana Fever, is a potential candidate. Thus far, the WNBA assistant pool has not been touched at all in this hiring round, despite interest in those coaches, plus Latricia Trammell of the LA Sparks, Christy Tolliver of the Phoenix Mercury. We'll see now how quickly the storm move. Now that Brondello is off the market, I wouldn't be shocked. I wouldn't be surprised if they hired a coach next week. There's not necessarily any specific hurry about it, but would love to, I'm sure, get that coach squared away and preparing for the 2026 season, even though we're a long ways away. October 31st is the expiration of the CBA. Clearly not going to be a deal done by then. Would expect we'll see some sort of adjustment to extend that another month or two while the sides continue negotiating, as we've seen in past situations. The other piece of storm news, so Dominique Bilunga first shared on Instagram that she had surgery to repair the wrist injury that affected her late in the regular season. She only missed one game. I believe that was against Chicago late in the regular season, but was playing with a brace on that wrist late in the year. And it did seem to maybe affect her at the free throw line, although the rest of her game was certainly intact. And then after that, a much wilder story. So Bilunga was set to play for Turkish club Fenerbahce, which is at this point, I think, the world's wealthiest international team, team participating in EuroLeague. Gabby Williams has played for them for a long period, or played for them last season, is still expected to play for them later this offseason, although she's in Seattle right now working out. So Fenerbahce posted that Bilunga was not going to report and that they would be, this is the translation from Turkish, taking all legal measures to deal with this situation. It's, since been reported by Annie Costable of Front Office Sports and others that, the big issue here is with Malunga's letter of clearance. So within FIBA, a letter of clearance is what says you are free to go from one team to the next. And the WNBA, as part of FIBA, sends that letter of clearance to these international teams when players go sign there during the offseason, and then the international team will send it back to let them play in the WNBA. So if Malunga's situation was not resolved with Fenerbahce, she would not be able to play for the Storm. She would also not be able to play for the French national team. Now, I don't think there's any... Today is October 23rd. The WNBA season, even if everything goes perfectly, training camp will not start for another 6 months. I don't think today there's any specific reason. It's worth getting worried about the possibility that Dominique Bilunga is not going to be able to play for the Storm. Like, it is in her best interest to play in the WNBA. She's going to want to be able to play for France in the 2026 World Cup, so on and so forth. I do think a resolution will be reached with Fenerbahce in the next 6 months, but it is an unexpectedly complicated situation at the present moment.
But sure, really no reason to worry specifically at the moment. It doesn't pass the sniff test.
That she wouldn't play in the WNBA?
Yeah, it's not going to happen.
I mean, I think, look, these situations have been resolved financially, between players and teams in the past. I think this is a somewhat different situation because Malunga signed a long-term contract with Fenerbahce and she is a very prominent player. So, and they are a very prominent, wealthy club that has the ability to go out there and if they mount a legal challenge to her contract to defend themselves against that. But I think that process will play out before April.
Let me ask longer term. Dollars are going up in the WNBA.
Yes.
There's going to come a time when WNBA owners are basically like, we don't want our players exposing themselves by going and playing in European basketball.
I mean, that was what the prioritization rule was to a degree.
Yeah, but that wasn't exactly a, like, don't do this. That was a get back on time sort of thing. That was a prioritize. Literally, it's called the prioritization rule. This is what is going to happen is, it's not like Kevin Durant goes and plays in Spain for a period of time, right?
I mean, it's a little different because of the fact that the timing of the seasons are always offset. And for international players, if the WNBA money gets big enough, maybe, but it's a higher bar than for, American players, I would say. So there may always be some degree of it.
I don't think it's going to be a thing in like 10 years.
I mean, I don't know. It also Unrivaled changes the equation to this to a degree.
I don't think it does either.
They're paying, I mean, even with WNBA increased salaries, I still think the Unrivaled is going to, that Unrivaled is going to be competitive with WNBA salaries. There's also this new league, Project B, that is being funded by Middle Eastern investors that is planning to sign players. And, you know, Unrivaled has very much been, this is a complement to the WNBA. Project B is thinking of itself more as a competitor to the WNBA long term.
I don't buy any of it, basically. Long term,
I think it's possible that all basketball we played in the Middle East in 10 years.
I mean, good luck. Also, I will say, if that's a brand that the NBA and the WNBA want, like, have fun, because the permanence of the importance of basketball in sure, right? But there are things that are more important than money, and the money isn't there without the fame in America. So I'm not even sure that I buy that either. You know what I mean? Like, all of these things have to exist. They have to coexist symbiotically. And I just don't think any of this is going to be an issue longer term. And I think everybody is incentivized. I think Fenerbahce is probably more concerned with this than, you know, this is the thing they're thinking about as well. And if they want to, like, make a model out of Dominique Malunga and have a fight about this, they're going to lose.
No, I don't think they are going to lose now.
They're not going to lose in the short term. They're going to lose in the long term. Like,
I think
European basketball does not want to go to war with the WNBA.
They're not going to the war with the WNBA.
But that's what this would signal.
No, it would not. I would not agree with that assessment.
Okay.
I think that, like, there's often situations where international teams, you know, fail to provide payment and things like that, and the disputes yield from something the international team did. In this case, there's no indication that that's the issue. All right, UW men's basketball beat UNLV 77-62 in a public exhibition last Sunday at Hackhead without several key players: Desmond Claude, ankle; Zoom Diallo, concussion; Christian Nitu, toe; and Kamari Peterson, hamstring, were all out with short-term injuries. Danny Sprinkle said all four of those players are expected to return to practice this week, and expected back in time for the season opener on November 3rd. Front court, you know, potential starter Jacob Ignacevich sidelined by a longer term foot injury. He is not going to be back for the start of the season. In their absence, the Huskies started freshman point guard JJ Mandiquit and Indiana transfer Bryson Tucker alongside typical starters Frank Kepnong, Wesley Yates III, and freshman Hannes Steinbach. Steinbach continued to build the hype coming off his dominant FIBA U19 World Cup with 22 points on 10 of 15 shooting and 16 boards, a full 8 of them on the offensive end. Bryson Tucker had 14 points on 6 of 9 shooting, very encouraging for a top prospect who struggled as a true freshman. And JJ Mandiquit, in his de facto college debut, was a point away from a double-double, handing out 12 assists. So the UNLV was also shorthanded. They're breaking in a new coach in Josh Pastner, but
Josh Pastner is the coach of UNLV?
He is. No longer my ESPN colleague. Stop me if you heard this before. The Huskies didn't shoot well on threes, going 5 of 17, but were 27 of 44, 61% inside the arc. So we'll actually preview the season next week. But
I can't believe we're there. I'm excited. All of this gets a hello from Husky basketball right now. I will say there's just a lot of dudes.
There are, and there's one more dude, because Jonathan Gavone, my former ESPN colleague of Draft Express, reported that the Huskies got a commitment from Serbian big man Nikola Zapina, who plans to enroll at the quarter break and would be eligible to play starting December 13th for the final four games of non-conference play. He, in the FIBA U19 World Cup, led Serbia with 16.4 points and one block per game, shooting 52% from the field, had played for the youth team of ACB club Valencia. One of the things we're seeing, or I guess I should say Valencia. One of the things we're seeing.
There we go. We hadn't gotten any condescending pronunciations since your return.
One of the things we're seeing.
It's a new Peltoncast tradition, 2 years in a row.
Love it. Is that, international teams historically have not paid very much for developmental players. And all of a sudden there's opportunity with NIL for those players to make more money in the United States. So we're seeing a lot of them come over. You know, when you look at the midseason addition, I think it's, and just the sheer depth of the team, you know, barring significant injuries, I think it's unlikely that Zapina plays a major role this season. But, you know, one of the things that Jonathan Givony highlighted was this is an 18-month commitment. So it's really about 2026-27 when, presumably based on the current trajectory, Hannes Steinbach is going to be in the NBA. And I mean, Ignacevic will be graduated.
But that's the thing with this Husky basketball team. You talk about how many players were out and how many players played well still beyond that. They're going to be able to find a rotation. And it's something where I think Danny Sprinkle might not know right now. You know, like, it's something that's probably going to evolve throughout the season. But I think by the end of the season, they're going to have a pretty good sense of who's good. And they're going to have like a solid 8-man rotation or something like that with the ability to go a little bit deeper.
Yeah. I mean, I think they're going to be deep.
And withstand injuries as well. You know, like, this is a team that it's in the past, it's been like Frank Kepnog's out and it is over. So I am feeling tentatively encouraged about Husky basketball. It is one of a situation where I'm like, I will believe it when I see it. And I don't think this UNLV scrimmage is enough yet, but
I didn't realize this. So when we did, this was when Jonathan was still at ESPN and alongside Jeremy Wu, their initial post NBA draft 2026 mock draft had Steinbach at that point. That's pre World Cup, number 26 in the 2026 draft. So
you think he might be a lottery pick?
I think that is very plausible. The hype train is moving.
If he wasn't going to be playing for the Huskies, he would be a player. He would be on that list next year.
That's true.
He would be a fucking lock to be on it. You think he might be drafted too high? He's like in Mbata Spuzelis territory.
I don't know if I don't think Buzelis was on the list last year, but possibly. Let me see here. Do we have
No, I'm saying Matos Buzelis was drafted too high to be on the list last year.
Yeah, I'm not. Well, I'm saying I wanted to make sure that he wasn't on the list.
Was he?
Because he does have a lot of on the list tendencies. But no, you're right. He was too high.
On the list tendencies. Well, he was a surprise pick too.
I did put Reed Sheppard on the list. He was the third.
I wanted to ask about Reed Sheppard. How is he?
It wasn't a great debut for him.
Your child?
Not debut. I mean, it was season opener, but his first real rotation game.
It is funny where he was like the third pick in the draft, right?
Yes.
Or second? He was third pick.
Third.
And I feel like you like personally like have this stake in Reed Sheppard, even though he was the third pick. It's not like you like went out on a limb necessarily.
It's all true. And yet, yes, I do have this personal stake. I mean, he had some good moments, but had a pretty crushing late game turnover in their double OT loss to the Thunder.
Well, and you should judge things by that one single game.
Exactly. All right, let's wrap up with UW football. Looking ahead to Saturday, and number 23, Illinois, coming to town for a 12:30 kickoff on Big Ten Network.
Hello!
Eli and I are coming off their first 10-win season since 2021 with Rep Bielema earning his first bowl win in his fourth year at Illinois. They opened this season ranked number 12, got up to number 9 after dominating 3 non-conference opponents, most notably a 45-19 win at Duke. And then were walloped 63-10 at Indiana. Came back from that with an impressive 34-32 win over USC. Lost 34-16 their last time out when they were hosting Ohio State. Don't know what that's like. Falling out of the AP Top 25 for 1 week before jumping back in at number 23 this week following their bye. Illinois is number 20 in FBI efficiency, 9 spots ahead of the Huskies. But intriguingly, even though they went 10-3 last year, their prior was very low, so they're actually 5 spots behind the Huskies in the overall predictive FPI, which is why the Huskies are heavily favored in this one by FPI. They're also 4.5-point favorites in Vegas. And I got to tell you, I think that one's wrong.
Really?
I think Illinois is good.
Okay.
Their QB, Luke Altmaier, highly experienced fifth college season, played sparingly in 2 years as a backup at Ole Miss. It started all 29 games he's played for the Illini. He's completed a career-high 72% of his passes for 9.5 yards per attempt. He's thrown just one pick in 192 attempts. Had been a rushing threat in the past, negative yardage was sacked thus far this season, but has run for a pair of touchdowns, actually caught one as well. He's eighth nationally in QBR, six spots out of Damon Williams Jr., and had a 700 and combined for 718 yards in their wins over USC and Purdue before just 248 on 44 attempts against the Buckeyes. His top target is senior Hank Beatty, who's already surpassed previous career totals with 39 catches for 617 yards. He's second in the Big Ten in receiving yards. He's also returned a punt for a touchdown this season. So a good little battle between him and Denzel Boston. And this one, there's a 300-headed running back committee for Illinois. Caden Fagan has a team-high 85 attempts, but just 4.0 yards per carry. Khalil Valentine had 154 yards combined against USC and Purdue, but just six on three carries against Ohio State before leaving due to injury. We'll see his status this weekend. And then veteran Aiden Loughery has averaged a team-high 6 yards per carry while battling injuries. He came back against Ohio State. Defensively, they're allowing 7.1 yards per pass attempt, which ranks 13th in the Big Ten. Have given up 300-plus yards three times, though all of those were in wins. Indiana was probably the more troubling performance. The Hoosiers completed 21 of 23 passes for 267 yards. This defense has benefited from fumble luck, recovering more than one per game as turnovers, and Gabe Jacobs has a team-high 4.5 sacks. So, in summary, this is a team that offensively has been basically just as good, maybe even, you know, they're 16th in FBI efficiency on offense. Huskies are 14th, but they have been better in terms of defense and particularly special teams than UW. I think they're the better team. I can buy the Huskies still being slight favorites because of home field, but I don't think they should be favored by 4.5.
Fair enough. I mean, it's going to be a fascinating game, I think, overall. Obviously, until the game at the end of the year, like the Jed's best chance at a more or less signature Big Ten win, right? This would be their second ranked Big Ten win ever, I believe, if they were to win it against a ranked opponent following Michigan last year. It feels like it bears situationally, not opponent-wise, it feels like it bears a lot of similarities to that Michigan game, where I think Michigan came in and was probably a better team. They didn't have the quarterback like Luke Altmaier, obviously, like Michigan was figuring out. They had a better defense, though. And they came in, UW was favored, and it was like, I think it was a similar time of year as well, right? Maybe it was like a couple weeks earlier.
It was October 5th, because it was before I left on my trip last year.
It feels like it's a very similar type of game, and that's kind of how bettors are seeing it, FPI being different. I think the thing that stands out to me is the, like, this USC game, right? Like, Jaden Maiava had 364 yard passing yards, and he didn't run for a ton, but he's not kind of the runner that DeMond is. They ran the ball well. Luke Altmaier is good, and he's efficient. This might be a shootout. You know, that one was 34 to 32, and I think it's basically like when DeMond has played against teams that are not Ohio State and Michigan, you could basically look at it. It's been a tale of two Damon Williams. And he has been absolutely dominant. And the Huskies have scored quickly. And I still think that's basically what people are betting on, is UW gets a stop or two against Illinois, which is possible. Like, the defense hasn't been terrible so far this year. I actually think the defense might be a little bit underrated statistically for UW.
Played generally a pretty good game against Michigan, I would say.
But Luke Altmaier is the best quarterback that they will have faced outside of Xavier Eckhouse, but like the best quarterback that UW, hey, the team that Wazoo I am on the fucking mountain. There was a Wazoo fan on Sunday at the children's baseball game that I was at, where he was like, what a terrible way to lose. Ah, I'm done with Wazoo. And I'm like, dog, you went into Ole Miss and almost beat them. And then the next week went into Virginia and almost beat them. You should be over the fuck. He was mad at Jimmy Rogers. And I was just like, have some perspective, my guy. Like, this team was dead in the water. You're in a two-person conference right now. Those are the most impressive losses you could possibly have. Your counterpart fired their coach and hasn't won a game in the conference.
It's all true.
They turned Zevi Eckhaus into a fucking star. So I am hyped. Like, that is UW's best win this year, I think. But
for the record, he has the Zevi Eckhaus has the third best QBR among quarterbacks UW has faced this season.
In the country? No, okay. But
Julian Sayin is number four overall in QBR, although he also was not very productive against this Illinois defense.
Luke Altmaier, Julian Sayin is number four in QBR. Luke Altmaier is a better quarterback than Julian Sayin is right now.
Sure, yeah, they've got very different weapons around them.
Offensive lines as well.
He went 19 of 27 for 166 yards in their Illinois win.
I think you kind of have to look at those two games, like that USC Illinois game. That one was there. USC is probably a little bit better than UW, but I'm not fully convinced of it.
I think USC is good.
I think UW is good also. Like, are you Katie over here?
I don't think UW is bad, but I'm saying, like,
USC Jane Mayava has
good.
Been a little bit better than DeMon Williams.
I mean, USC is top 10 in FPI efficiency. UW is good, but they're not
overrated.
Top 10.
But I think you look at that game, they both scored a ton of points, and it was in the fourth quarter, Illinois outlasted them, basically. You know, and it's like, that's probably what this game is going to look like. Again, the fumble luck, like you talked about. But look at these drives from US. And they had to come down and hit a field goal to win it, right? And did they miss a two-point conversion? Oh, they kicked an extra point to take a one-point lead. Look at these drives from USC. Fumble, touchdown, downs, which was, I'm always like, downs that you probably could process. Field goal. Interception, a one punt in there, touchdown, touchdown, touchdown. Like, if UW has a similar run and instead of two turnovers, they have one, they might not punt in this game. It's a win for UW, right? If that's kind of the profile that we're looking at and the offense moves the way that it should, that it showed against Michigan before stalling, I think the real question to me is, can they score in the red zone? Or is it going to be Grady Gross field goals? And
sometimes,
I don't.
Sometimes Grady Gross miss field goals.
I don't know if Illinois is the type of defense. That's what Ohio State did, and that's what Michigan did. Is they kicked field goals in those games, and they didn't score touchdowns. But that hasn't been the case anywhere else on the schedule. Starting with the second half in Maryland, maybe even like the third quarter against Maryland, they have been able to get into the end zone. And when UW is doing that, they're an extraordinarily hard team to beat. Because the threshold is you basically need to score. When they are moving like that, it is a relentless offense. So I can see where the bettors are coming from, where FBI is coming from in this game. Illinois is going to be on the road. It's their first time here. They're traveling across the country. At the time of date, I don't think it doesn't really affect anybody, but can UW get a couple of stops, and can DeMon Williams be relentless in this game? And if he can, then UW will come out with a ranked victory in the Big Ten.
Percentage chances of victory?
I thought the 62% from FPI seemed pretty good to me.
I'm at like 55%, I would say.
I thought you were going to say wrong team favored.
No, I think, again, I think Illinois is the better team, but I do think home field, particularly with the travel, probably does favor UW.
I mean, it's kind of the most interesting game on the schedule right now. Obviously, it's the next game on the schedule, but this is an important game for UW to win. Michigan was important, but it was like, this is a loss they could take. They're not really going to be in playoff conversation. If they lose this one, playoff's gone. It is not even, there's no chance.
I mean, it's just not even something we should be thinking about right now.
It's not something we should be thinking about right now, but it's something that they're thinking about. And they are saying we need to win out to make the playoffs.
Illinois' losses last year are very funny. They lost at Penn State, at Oregon, which we've seen those, and then home to Minnesota.
It happens. Parity is kind of the name of the game in the Big Ten and probably college football.
I guess Minnesota was decent last year.
In general. But, you know, a big game for the Big Ten. And I think they're thinking about this as like, this every game is a must-win game. And this is a huge game. It's a huge game for Jed Fish. It's a huge game for this UW season. And basically, like, I think this game is going to kind of teeter on, do we consider this a successful season or not? I think this is going to be the most important of those, like, sliding doors games, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, especially because they've got other competitive games between now and then, but the other, like, hardest game on the schedule is at the very end in terms of Oregon. So it's hard for this season to sort of, like, you know, for things to spiral out if you lose to Oregon in the way that there is perhaps a chance of that if you lose this one and lose two in a row.
What is the... Okay, I want to pull up FPI defensively for efficiencies.
They're 44. You're looking at UW?
No, I'm looking at Michigan's defense.
Oh, better.
Which is actually, yeah, not that good. Wait, where is Michigan? Oh, yeah, number 22 FPI efficiency. I still think that that's like a Michigan defense that's 22 in FPI efficiency, but in the Big House is just better. And they got lucky. Michigan was lucky in that game.
Yeah. I mean, I think the UW will put up points in this game. I think you're right that I would take the over, even though I'm sure the total is quite high.
Michigan's played very few games in the Big House.
It would also be nice just to, like, have more plays. These Big Ten games do not feature enough plays.
I thought it was the Rutgers.
This is my hot take. I don't think football should use a clock. I think it should be an alternating number of possessions.
That's a pretty stupid hot take. No, I don't know. But, like, Michigan, they just really have not played that many games, it feels like. Like, at the Big House, they've played 4 games total, and it was like they gave up 17 to New Mexico, 3 to Central Michigan, 10 to Wisconsin, 7 to us. And they went on the road and kind of got their ass kicked by USC and gave up. They lost a close game at Oklahoma and then beat Nebraska, but gave up quite a few points. But I'm like, that it's like a top 15 defense. I don't really buy that they're actually 22. And Ohio State's obviously good. So those are the two teams that had the speed and the skill to actually stop DeMond running the ball. Illinois does not have that.
Yeah, I mean, you've said it well. That's been the bellwether for the Huskies this season.
It's going to be fun, though. 12:30 Saturday in October. This is like a real Big Ten game, is what it feels like to me. You know,
especially because it's going to be pouring rain. So
that too. We'll see. I don't pouring rain.
What do you mean? We'll see if it's going to be pouring rain. The forecast is going to be pouring rain all day. It's not 2 days from now. They're not going to be that far off.
Not pouring rain.
It's not as rainy as it's going to be on Friday. I looked at the forecast today and I was like, it's going to be cold and it's going to be gray and it's going to last for the rest of your life.
Yeah. We've seen it.
So on that note.
Thanks for listening.
The Pelton Cast will be here to keep you warm.
We're back.
Hot stove league.
We podcast 3 times this week.
We recorded 3 times. I don't know if we technically podcasted 3 times, but yes.
Yeah, we are so back. This is like a real nice podcast. Thanks. You know what I mean, though? It's like it feels like it's like we're in the Big Ten now playing a game like this against Illinois.
Yeah.
It's just like a Friday night against Rutgers. It's not like it doesn't feel like a Big Ten game. You're just like, you ever played Friday night against Rutgers?
It's odd because Rutgers and Illinois are both teams the Huskies played non-conference series against within our time having season tickets.
I remember the Rutgers game pretty well, but the Illinois one, I'm kind of like a little hazy.
I remember the game against Illinois much more because I want to say it was played at Soldier Field, if I remember correctly.
Oh, yes, I think that's right. Yep.
Was that even the Sark era? I mean, it was probably a long time ago now. When I say, you know, within memory, that encompasses a long period of time because we're very old. But it was a fun game, as I remember it. I think that would have been Lovie Smith's Illinois era.
Yeah, I remember that. We beat them, right?
Yeah. Yeah, 34-24 at in Chicago.
Are you just like so like what is the term? Like beyond thinking about Jed leaving, like you just don't care at all. That doesn't cross your mind.
Like, let's win a game and worry about that if they win a game.
Who's the dude from The Watchmen? You're just like on your planet sitting alone, not worried about Judd Fish leaving.
Like, people were up in arms because the 2026 commit flipped from UW to UCLA. It's like, you know, the thing about not caring about recruiting in the first place is you don't care when the recruits flip. Like, call me when they get on campus. I'm good.
There was somebody posted where it's like, it's a sign that Jed's going to UCLA. And I'm like, he told the recruit. I was like, walk me through this.
It's like 5D chess.
Jed was like, okay, I'm just letting you know. You're committed to UW right now. But don't wait until I've taken the job at UCLA. Do it now. Put just like a breadcrumb out there.
Like, he's fucking Taylor Swift.
Yeah, no, I kind of love that. You're like, but I love the, like, Ozymandias. You're like ESPN senior writer Kevin Pelton. I don't even think about Jed Fish leaving. Because I had like a genuine against Michigan where I was like, we're going to beat Michigan and then our fucking coach is going to leave again. It was like, I hate that college football. Like, you have to. I was telling Reese this yesterday where I was like, the good thing with the NFL is like, you just, the shit is just like locked in.
You know what I mean? Could be the same. There's nothing different in the rules in college in the NFL.
I mean, there's a lot of things different in the rules in college and the NFL. There's
but not
a
in terms of
cap.
Coaching contracts. The contracts are the contracts.
It's
I guess it's just that there's not draft picks to trade, because in the NFL, the reason it doesn't happen is because you would demand a draft pick. So maybe when we get draft picks in college, the coaches will stop moving around as much.
I'd be down for that. I think it's also just like the system is way more rigged in college than it is in the NFL.
No, it's just because of the fact that there's way more stratification. Like, there's not, like, there are some NFL teams that are paying more and some that are paying less, but there is nothing on the scale of all of NCAA Division I. That's the reason for it.
But I like UW and Florida. Like, I don't even know where Mike McDonald went to college. Or anything, you know what I mean? It just doesn't. I guess that's another piece of it, is the way that you're attached to a college is different than like your first job. You know what I mean? It's not like,
yeah,
like
true.
If the Ravens job opens up, or like, fuck, Mike McDonald's going to the Ravens, you know?
Yeah,
because it's more of like, I just feel like you treat them like a business, but college you just treat as like it's like a deeper commitment or something if you went there. Which might not be true. Like, we don't know if coaches, it might just be that coaches use like going to a college as an excuse to go like get paid more money.
I mean, I think there definitely are coaches like Jim Elmora, like coaching at UW was definitely his dream the entire time.
Didn't he basically turn down the job, or do you think they
wanted, he got offered it?
He just didn't, they didn't inquire.
I mean, I'm sure they inquired, but then Chris Peterson said yes, and they were like, okay, let's do it. Which, but, by the way, one of the things I was thinking about recently, I forget when this was. I guess this is when people were like down on the idea that Jed Fish could ever be successful. And, you know, and when I say people, I mean, this was a comment on, the, you know, one perspective on the Discord. And it's like, there was a significant period where we weren't sure whether Chris Peterson was actually going to translate to a power conference.
No,
like,
I mean,
that was
he
a legitimate
a
question.
I think people
he
treat
had
stuff
two,
as like,
not a few, but he had two.
Well, two is a few, but like people treat stuff like it's like such a permanent thing with
two
coaches.
Is a couple, for the record.
Van was talking about how like the Florida hiring is going to basically be like chalk hire. And it's basically like they need to re-engage the boosters right now. And they're not going to go try to get the next Urban Meyer or whatever, because I'm talking about Urban Meyer when they hired him from Utah. And because they need to go get somebody where it's like they've got to excite people with like a name and get people re-engaged. And I think they were basically just being like, that's going to mean that they're not going to get somebody as good. And I'm like, I don't know. We don't fucking know. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know if even like college coaches are important, but the reasons that college coaches are important are kind of like a little bit tenuous. And the amount of coaches who get to the status of Kirby Smart, Dabo, like, it's basically like a tier of, like, Sark isn't there, you know? Nick Saban.
No, I don't think Sark is there. You saw the final score on Saturday.
I think there would be people like Ryan Day could have multiple national championships and leave, and people would be like, oh, he can't do it anywhere else. So I don't know. It's something that people, I think, are like, it's way more on whatever you have in that current year's talent, I think, than it is something that's greater than that. Like, having an offensive scheme, I think, is an important thing to have that you can take with you. But like with Mike McDonald, he's 38. And you're like, if Mike McDonald is good for the Seahawks coach, he's just going to be the Seahawks coach. He could be the Seahawks coach for 30 years if things went well. But it's not like we're going to be like, fuck, I'm so worried that Mike McDonald's going to go somewhere else. It's just like, that's it. He's the coach. And it would be kind of fascinating if it were like that, like Dan Campbell's just like, yeah, I'm the coach of the Packers now.
I mean, obviously it happens from time to time. But again, because of the fact that you have to give up draft picks in addition to the money, it makes it much harder.
I wonder if there's like, yeah, I think that's what we need. So you think the draft pick's the thing that changes it?
I think so.
I was trying to think of when the last times, I guess, John Gruden and Mike Holmgren.
It has to have happened more recently than that, hasn't it? Maybe not.
Oh, Mike McDonald went to Georgia.
I did remember that at some point. NFL coaches traded. I remember there's a lot of talk about Jim Harbaugh, whether he was going to get... Oh, Sean Payton did technically get traded.
Yeah, but that was different.
It was different.
He wasn't traded because he didn't immediately...
Oh, we probably should mention Bill Belichick and Bill Parcells here.
I don't know. It just doesn't happen very often.
No. No, it is definitely few and far between. The fact that we can remember the times that it did happen as clearly as we can.
If Kirby gets fired, to be like, is Mike McDonald going to go to Georgia? But it's also like, it's just, I don't know. I do think there's going to be more movement between college and the NFL as time goes on.
Wow, the Jets got a 4th-round pick for Herm Edwards. Drafted Leon Washington with the pick. Seahawks legend. Bruce Arians had to get traded for the same reason as Peyton. So there you go.
I also was thinking about like Brian Callahan, where it's funny, where it's like Brian Callahan could be an NFL coach, but I'm like, I don't think he could go. He could maybe get like a small college job, but it's like the Titans are not equivalent to like a big college program.
Well, getting fired from the Titans. It's not like if you get, it's not like, you know.
Well, even when he was hired as the Titans head coach.
But it's not like if, who's the coach of Florida, Billy Napier? It's not like he's going to go to Penn State. Like, obviously he's going to go down a level. So I don't think that's
when
fair.
He was hired as offense, when he was offense coordinator of the Bengals and then was hired as head coach of the Titans, I don't think he could have just gone to Florida. It's almost
no,
like
probably
you get
not.
Like stuck in these world, like shoddy, which granted, like,
well, there is a friction to it. There's a transaction cost.
Brian Schottenheimer is a genius head coach, as we know. But like, I don't think he just happened to find himself as the head coach of the Dallas Cowboys.
Yeah.
And I don't think, like, again, I don't think he could have just like gotten the Penn State job.
No.
It's kind of a strange thing how that works between the two, where it's like you need to be successful in this world to be able to go get that job. And then if you are successful, you can move between the two, sort of, but
maybe not anymore.
I mean, there haven't been that many, like Matt Rhule has been fine, but coaches who've coached in the NFL who've been successful at college, like let's say Jed left, like I don't think there's like fired NFL coaches that I'd be happy with.
Jim Elmore?
Yeah.